open the House Committee on Business and Labor, and I am going to... open a public hearing on House Bill 2595.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard House Bill 2595 on February 27th. It requires home health agencies and hospice programs to accommodate nurses to provide home health for hospice services on an hourly basis, and also requires the Department of Human Services to enforce compliance on the measure. You have in front of you a -3 amendment, which replaces the bill's language. It removes the provision that requires nurses be paid on the hourly basis, providing more flexibility on how they're compensated. The amendment also moves the enforcement of the measure from DHS to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and also allows the commissioner to adopt rules to carry out the measure's provisions. We do have the impact statements. There is a minimal fiscal impact on the amendment. You also have a memo from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, which expresses that they're comfortable with the amendments. You have a number of letters of opposition from nurses from around the state, and they wanted that information to be entered into the record.
You say the amendments were here?
Yes, it should be in the packet. Bring up the sheet.
I don't have the amendments.
We'll get them.
All right, I'd like to call Brian DeLashmit, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. If you'll notice on the sign-in sheet, I signed in if necessary. So I'm here just answering the questions. The -3s accomplish what the Oregon Nurses Association set out to accomplish with this bill. The one discussion that we did have with proponents or the initial opponents of the bill was the way the language was written. It would only have allowed them to pay on an hourly basis. This language allows the flexibility to either pay them on a as a salary or on a hourly basis or a combination thereof. It just bans pay-per-visit in itself. So, and that's what we attempted to accomplish in the original bill. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. DeLashman this morning? Representative Kenneman?
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I haven't had a chance to review these. What's the difference then between -1 and -3s? Because -1s give permissive language as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kenneman, I'd have to go back and try and find the -1s and figure out what they actually accomplished.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. The committee report is the -3s. I'm fine. Thank you. I just read that.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Thacker.
Sorry, I'm feeling like I'm just catching up because I just got a copy because I'm waiting for my computer to three beer load up. Quote my friend here.
Wow, we are.
I'm still waiting for my screen to appear, so I haven't seen the amendment. Is this an amendment you brought forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thacker, yes, it is. It's an amendment we brought forward in continuing to work with the people that had some concerns about only paying on an hourly basis.
Okay.
And so we attempted to clarify that all we're trying to do is keep them from paying on a per visit basis to encourage those issues that we talked about last time. So this amendment is brought forward in an attempt to allow them some flexibility to either pay salary or pay hourly or pay a combination thereof that they work out with their employees.
Okay, and then I guess I have a follow-up on what the opposition is from folks that you're hearing, because I'm still waiting for this to load up.
Lisa, would you repeat or further elaborate what the opposition was that you spoke of earlier?
Oh, the letters? Well,
just give me a brief.
There were a number of individual nurses, hospice nurses from around the state, particularly in Eastern Oregon. There's 6 letters that were sent to me individually and asked that they be entered into the record. I haven't had a chance to be honest with you, Representative Thacker, to review all of these to give specific rationale behind them. They were given to me probably on Wednesday, and I just haven't had the opportunity. If you want to hold 1 minute, I can look at that.
I think we should hear I think we should hear what the opposite, or at least the gist of the opposition.
Why don't you read one of the letters? Is there one that's better than the other?
I have one that's like a paragraph long, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you just read that right into the record?
Okay, Mr. Chair. This is from Cheryl Conklin, who's a nurse, I believe she's from Hefner, to the House Business and Labor Committee. I would like to notify you that I am against the proposal of the House Bill number 2595 that would ban the pay-per-visit option for nurses in the state of Oregon. I've worked in the home health industry for over 15 years and have worked under several pay scales. I've been compensated by salary, hourly, and pay-per-visit, and have given the same care to patients no matter what the compensation has been. The company I work for compensates fairly, and the patients and our referral sources are pleased with the care the patients receive and tell us that regularly. Please do not pass Bill number 2595 and take the freedom to have our choice in our industry. Please make this letter a part of the official committee record and make sure each member receives a copy. Thank you.
And we can put that up against what we heard at the first hearing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
So there's several of those letters?
Yes.
Do we all have copies of all
yes,
those letters?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron. They were emailed and
okay.
Also they should be in the member packets.
Yeah, okay, I see.
Any further questions of Mr. DeLashmet?
Just a question. Anyone else scheduled to testify today?
No. Brian is the only one signed up. And I don't see the lobbyist for the...
She is here.
Sarah, Ms. Myers, would you like to testify on this? You're here. I'm offering you an opportunity. If you don't want to, it's okay. I want to put you on the spot, but since you're here...
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Myers. I'm the Executive Director to the Oregon Association for Home Care. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, and I do understand that there were a number of nurses from around the state, as Teresa indicated, that had submitted testimony on their behalf.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. I assume you're comfortable with the permissive language of the Dash 3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, we worked with the lobbyists for the ONA, both lobbyists for the ONA, to remove the language that would have required agencies, both home health and hospice, to pay by the hour. I think that as an organization, as an industry, we are neutral on the proposed bill. I think that Oregon has not pervasively operated under a pay-per-visit model. I think that the testimony thus far from the proponents is fear-based and not fact-based because of that fact that there has not been that broad-based operation in this particular state. And I don't think that maybe necessarily all of the information either for or against has been brought forward in terms of data or empirical that might state a case for or against this. You know, if we looked at, for example, things from other states. However, as I said, our organization on behalf of Oregon is neutral on this particular bill, and we are deferring to the individual letters from nurses who have or haven't operated under this particular compensation methodology.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, seeing none.
Thank you
very much. Would anyone else like to testify today on this bill? We're in a public hearing. We're going to work it here in a minute. Now's your chance. All right, seeing none. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2595. And which of the dashes?
The dash 3.
I would entertain a motion to put the dash 3 amendments into the bill.
So moved.
Mr. Chair, as soon as you open a work session,
open a work session. Representative.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee adopt the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2595.
Representative Holy moves the dash 3 amendments in House Bill 2595. Is there discussion?
Chair, just a comment. I like the permissive language, and I understand there are pros and cons on both sides. One of as a provider myself, it would be nice to get paid and just do things at your own pace. On the other hand, you have to budget these things too, and I think this is a nice compromise that allows people to work it out.
Well, thank you for that, Representative. We try to get everyone, as many people to yes as we humanly can in this building. With that, any further discussion? Is there any opposition to the dash threes? All right, so I would entertain a motion to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2595 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Holy moves House Bill 2595 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? All right, then. So moved. Would someone like to carry this bill on the floor? Representative Witt. All right, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2595. I'm open a public hearing on House Bill 2732.
Actually, Mr. Chair, we can only do a work session.
Oh, forgive me. Work session, House Bill 2732.
I'll explain why. Thank you, Mr.
That's
Chair. House Bill 2732 actually is the first bill that's come to us from the Subcommittee on Workforce Development, which is why it is a work session as opposed to a public hearing. And normally, Kevin Christensen, who is the administrator for the sub, would be here, but he is unavailable today, so I'm pinch hitting for him. House Bill 2732 creates the Career and Technical Education Collaboration Task Force and designates the membership of the task force. The task force is required to identify collaborations and partnerships that are related to career and technical education that are currently established, make recommendations regarding increasing collaborative efforts and using partnerships for the purpose of better sharing facilities and resources and developing a high-skill, high-wage, sustainable workforce. Members, you have in front of you three amendments. The dash one came forward from the subcommittee, which changes the membership to include expand the membership to 11 members to include ones for representative from a career school and a nonprofit organization. The dash two amendment is from Representative Kenemer and changes the focus of the task force from K through 12 to grades 7 to 16 and adds additional provisions for the task force to work on. The dash three amendment is from Representative Dembro and adds the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development as a task force member and requires the Department of Community Colleges, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Employment Department to share staffing support. Right now, with the bill as is with the dash one, the Department of Education will be staffing the task force. And last but not least, the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. We have our colleagues here before us, and then there's a couple nice people that want to testify to it, and we're going to go ahead, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. My colleague, Representative Dembro, and I have actually started this process with the direction of our chair and our fellow representatives in the workforce development. What you see in front of you is basically what we had extracted out of numerous public hearings. It came to our attention what needed to be done would to have some sort of a plan to where you take your high schools and your community colleges and your private sectors, your journeyman tracks, your apprenticeships into the blue-collar labor force, as well as government, and get us on the same page so we can have some sort of a seamless way for a youngster that has an interest into the blue-collar workforce to be able to transfer it in themselves from high school into community college into an apprenticeship program and or the workforce itself. We have come up with this plan in front of us that creates a task force, actually, that will allow us to have some sort of a plan by the next time. In fact, I think it's October, I believe, if my memory serves me correct. And this will give us an opportunity to have some sort of a plan and a mission statement and a goal for us as legislators in order to achieve this goal for our youngsters. The thing that became very apparent in the task force, in our work group and in our committee was that one, everyone agreed that this needed to be done. Two, some people do it, but I don't know if we're getting very good results from that. And three, some people have a great program in place, but they have yet, but they are doing a great job. So we have three different types of issues going on here. The other thing that came out, which we need to emphasize very much as not only as a legislature, but as a Department of Education needs to bring out, 82% of all children, I repeat, 82% of all children that enter high school do not graduate out of college. Yet, everything in high school is geared toward college. So basically, we're leaving out 82% of the kids that end up doing something different than graduating out of college. The other thing I think that came out to me that was almost rocked me, I guess one would say, disturbed me, was we do not put respect into our blue-collar workforce in our high schools. It's almost as if you're a failure if you don't go to college. I don't subscribe to this, and neither do any of us on the workforce, on our committee. I think that it's something that's very respectful. I think it's something that, and I do a quick comparison, gee, a plumber makes a lot more money than most people in the state of Oregon. An electrician makes a lot more money than most people in the state of Oregon. I know a builder does, except, of course, the last year. But they make great money. And yet we aren't gearing things towards our blue-collar workforce. And it's time that we did. It's time we brought respect back into the labor force and our blue-collar workers in the state of Oregon. It's time that we realize that we have quite a void here that needs to be filled. When our economy picks up, we're going to have trained workers in order to do the building, to do the economic growth in the state of Oregon. If it's embarking upon a stimulus package to do our infrastructure, you're going to need construction workers to construct those bridges, to construct those roads, and to do the necessary work that we need to achieve our infrastructure. So with that, I'll leave it with Representative Dembrough here. He and I actually got together and crafted this out. So without further ado.
Thank you. Colleagues, my name is Michael Dembrough. I'm the representative for House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Road. And it's a pleasure for me to bring this bill before you. And I just want to thank Representative Esquivel for his partnership on this. This is a bill that's all about partnerships. And it really had its genesis, as Representative Esquivel said, in, you know, looking at the potential for greater partnerships between K-12 systems, community colleges, industry, unions, apprenticeship programs, et cetera. There are good things that are happening out there, but there are a lot of missed opportunities. And it became very clear that we need to get key people working on this jointly to do an assessment of where we are and to make recommendations of how we can be doing this better so that we can move young people into these middle skills jobs. Actually, middle skills is a term I prefer. The term I prefer is pivotal skills, because they really are the pivot of the workforce. As the bill came out, it was missing one key element, and that's why we have a dash 3 amendment, and that is we need to have someone on the task force who represents CCWD as the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. They're obviously a key player in this, and ultimately the vision of the task force is that the staffing would be shared, again it really speaks to the partnership element of this, by the Department of Education, the Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So that's what the Dash 3 Amendment does, and it's a really important part to the basic philosophy of this bill. And having said that, I'm sure we'd be willing to answer any questions.
Any questions of these gentlemen?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
And I direct this question to either you or anybody else that is going to testify later. There's been a lot of talk in the interim and folks working on workforce development type issues. What's the justification? I understand where you're trying to go, but why do we need an official task force to get everybody at the table? I kind of thought that a lot of this stuff was happening already and in the background, and maybe I'm wrong, or maybe you just need the political oomph to kind of force everybody to sit down and direct it. And could you just talk to that a little bit,
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Representative Edwards. I'll be very blunt.
Thank you.
Talks cheap, takes money to buy whiskey. And everyone's talking, but no one's buying. Some people are. We found some great programs that are very successful. We found other programs, I think, that are just a mouthpiece. So therefore, we need to solidify those on a statewide basis. We need to make sure that we have an avenue and a vehicle for this to happen, and we need to have some accountability.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I always was partial to the term blue-collar or blue-collar skilled, because that is not just the pivotal, but the backbone, the foundation, the heartbeat of America. So, and you know what, we, in my life, I've seen a lot of people just out there trying, thinking they're going to, and some of them did, get rich by doing nothing. You know, whether they're consultant or hustling the market, or a lot of them are in jail now, I'm glad to say. But what we need to do in this country is just put back the value and respect in a good day's work. And that's lacking. And when I was a kid in school, we had, that's why I graduated from high school, because I had welding and metals and plastics and wood shop. I loved those classes, and that's why I went to school. But it's gone away, and we're paying for it, too. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I would
sir.
Like to add one thing. I thought this came up out of the committee, and I thought it was very good. We can send to college and graduate all the engineers in the world, but you know something? It doesn't build the bridge.
Got that right, Representative. Any further questions of these gentlemen?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and both representatives for bringing this concept forward. A couple things. Are we going to consider the Dash 2 amendments to expand this to grades 16?
We can. If someone would like to just speak to the Dash 2s, that's fine.
Okay, and then maybe they don't have the answer. But
that's right. Whoever wants to speak to it.
The second question and would be, because if we're really, I'm looking at the purpose of what the purpose says in Section 1, and yet the membership of this group, where your amendment asks for community colleges and workforce development member, we already have another member on, where was it? Community college teacher or administrator at a community college. So we've got two slots in here for community colleges, and I'm wondering why we're limiting the purpose through grade 12. And the last thing I would like to hear comments on is if this is truly about expanding those jobs out there and training people for those jobs, having one member who represents labor and one member who represents business or industry, I think is kind of limited to really getting what the needs are of business and labor out in the field. I look at this, and I appreciate us bringing forward, but having something that's very practical that makes things happen, getting people out there that are making it happen versus having a big task force with a whole bunch of state representatives and elected officials or that don't have a real world view like somebody from labor and or business would be. I just my own couple comments, and maybe there was some deliberation you could respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the reason for two people from community colleges is the individual who's designated under B, the teacher or administrator at community college, is there to give sort of the real world on the ground kind of perspective to what's happening in a particular program. What the CCWD is able to do is they really are exposed to, you know, the array of programs that are happening around the state that can serve as models, and the sort of national perspective on workforce development issues. So they're overlapping in some ways, but they're really providing, I think, distinct perspectives.
Thank you. Follow up if I may. So that makes sense. I understand that. Then is there a reason why the purpose is not through grade 16?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Cameron. Or 14?
Yeah, I have no objection to that. That's how the concept was originally sent to Ledge Council.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Holvey, then Representative Kenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one who sat on this subcommittee, I will say that I appreciate Representative Dimbrough's desire to add the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to the list, and really have not any great objections to that. I mean, we do have one member, as he said, who is a teacher administrator at a community college. I would think that would be ample, but notwithstanding that, I guess I do have a little bit of concern, because as we talked in the committee of having the Department of Education, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and Community Colleges and Workforce Development all staffing this one task force, it seems to me we have a fiscal on the dash one, and now we're going to have three agencies doing the staffing. It just seems to me that's overkill and potentially adds a little more fiscal. I know we don't have the fiscal on dash three, but it seems like it's not really that efficient to have three agencies trying to staff something. Those agencies are represented on the task force, so they have the input. And, so notwithstanding that, I prefer the dash ones, and I think it's a much cleaner bill that way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, you can rest at ease, because we're not working this bill today, because the chair doesn't really know what's going on. Representative Kenner.
Welcome to my world, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of interesting. You know, we began tilling these vineyards quite a long time ago with a grant back in the previous century for a place called to create the Sabin Skill Center in North Clackamas. And I have two of the experts who are now there at what's called the Sabin Schellenberg Center.
And they're going to come forward.
And they have dash two amendments, which I think it might be appropriate to have them, because they've been working on this issue for a long time. I think what it does is it helps improve this bill. At least that's my hope.
Yeah,
and I'd like to hear from them in due course.
Be patient. Representative Esquivel had something to say.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. As for the reason, the inclusion of three different entities is because we thought it would be thoughtful, which we discussed in committee, that all three entities, you may have a third, a third, and a third. It gives them the opportunity to do so. That's why you have staffing with three people. We're not going to have three people staffing it. We're going to share that equally, is the intent.
Sharing the cost.
Yep.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any further questions of these good gentlemen before I call our friends from the Sabin Schellenberg Skill Center up? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forgot to denote, you know, we did have a conversation in the dash ones is including the as well a nonprofit organization and also a representative of private technical career schools as well, and they don't appear in the dash threes as well, and I think the nonprofit would, you know, represent people like perhaps Schellenberg, maybe they're, I'm not sure if you are a nonprofit, the Schellenberg, Sabin Schellenberg. But there are other nonprofit organizations out there that do provide workforce and educational opportunities as well. So anyway, I just thought I'd put that on the record.
The people we're going to hear from, it's in the North Clackamas School District, where the chair's little girl is getting a great education. She's in ninth grade. She gets straight A's, and she's brilliant and beautiful, just like her mom. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr.
And
Chair.
And we're going to be moving on here shortly. Thank you.
Just to be quite frank, as Chair Witt, and we all know, we brought this forward so this committee could have the final chewing of this to figure out what way we actually wanted to go. I believe that was our conversation before we brought this bill forward. So that is the intent of our subcommittee, was to bring this to the full committee, and if we have any amendments, we were willing to do so at that point. And I believe that is exactly what our conversation was.
Great. Representative, do you have any final words?
Just call me if you need me.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. All righty, then. I'm going to call my friend Deborah Barnes and Ron Dexter.
Hi, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ron Dexter. I'm the Director of Career and Technical Education at Concordia University. I was formerly the Director at the Save and Skill Center, and I was also a former Associate Superintendent for the Department of Education for Career and Technical Education. In 2005, I authored Senate Bill 364, which was passed unanimously in House and Senate and signed by the governor in 2006. Senate Bill 364 appointed a statewide CTE task force to study and make recommendations for six critical issues facing current technical education in Oregon. The task force was a total of 18 members appointed by five people, including the governor. I served on the task force as well as did Deborah Barnes. And maybe let me just take a moment and let me have her introduce herself.
Good morning. I'm Deborah Barnes. I teach the Broadcasting and Digital Media Program at the Sabin-Schulenburg Center, and I have done so for the past 15 years. And I was vice chair of the Senate Bill 364 Workforce Task Force 2005.
I just wanted to say, Ms. Barnes, I've been to their center, and these kids interview all kinds of folks involved in the public doing all kinds of things, and they do a great job, and they had a difficult time finding a camera angle to make me look halfway good, but they almost pulled it off with all their skill. It's really a great place, and I really enjoyed coming and doing that, and you can just see that these kids they're excited to be doing it, and it really is a great experience for them, whether they go into communications or not. And I really whenever we drive by the ag, there's an ag part too, and my daughter whenever we drive by there, I remember when I was like in first grade or whenever it was, they toured that. So there's just a lot going on there, and I just cannot express my appreciation for that and the value that's in all what you're doing up there. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler.
My pleasure.
We got to do a live election night show with those kids. Unlike any other, we have advisory panel members, and one of whom is KATU's anchor, Steve Dunn. And so my kids got to go out to Channel 2 and learn from him, and then they came back, and we had two adults join our anchors. And for two straight hours, election night, we did live election night coverage, covering everything in Clackamas County so that the local folks could see the local races. It was a wonderful experience for the students.
And keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Go ahead, sir.
First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Escobol for bringing this bill forward. I see it as an opportunity to continue the work that the previous CTE statewide task force has done. There is a study that was conducted, led by the Oregon Department of Education and conducted by a research outfit out of California called MTR. And the study is called the Oregon CTE study. It was completed in August of 2008. And when I first read House Bill 2732, I had two or three concerns. One is the language about the K-12. If the purpose of the bill is to establish collaborative partnerships, then the first thing that became apparent to me is that it should include community colleges and higher education. And so that was one amendment that I am proposing, is that it be grade 7 through 16, because I believe that at the middle school, we should be looking at current technical education more exploratory, not full-blown current technical ed programs, but current technical education really should start at least the middle school level. Some could argue that we need to do more at the elementary level in terms of career exploration, but for the purposes of the task force, I would propose that it be grade 7 through 16. Your question, Representative Cameron, about the, I think it was your question about the purpose of including higher ed. If the intent of the task force is to develop partnerships, higher ed definitely needs to be a part of this. There needs to be a career pathway, many career pathways for all students to go through community college and higher education. One of the amendments is for an applied baccalaureate degree. And I learned yesterday that House Bill 3093 is specifically written to create a, sponsored by Representative Dave Edwards, specifically written for creating an applied baccalaureate degree. So that really kind of took care of the amendment that I'm proposing, and I've left it out in my testimony today, but I just want to mention that to the committee. But I still believe that the task force should address CTE issues and workforce development issues through grade 16, through higher education. And specifically, I would hope that OIT be involved in that task force. A couple other concerns, it would be, and I didn't include this in one of my proposed amendments, but well, in terms of appointment on the task force, I believe someone from higher ed should be on the committee. Maybe specifically I would propose OIT because they're going to be more interested, I think, in the applied baccalaureate degree than other institutions, but I can't speak for OUS on that. The other is it would be helpful to have a timeline for the appointment of the committee because what happened the last time, and it was partly my fault because I wrote into the bill that four or five people got to select the committee, and that created a delay. And it would really be helpful if there was a specific timeline fairly after the bill passes that the committee is appointed, within at least 60 days. I think it took almost a year to get the committee appointed last time. That really messed up the timeline for the committee to do its work and report back to the legislature. So it would really be helpful if there was a timeline for the committee to be appointed. And I think with that, I'll just open it up and ask, do you have any questions?
Any questions of these good people? I had woodshop in junior high, so I tell you, we can't keep doing. And money's an issue. We believe me, it's horrible. Just to let you know, mm-hmm. as an educator, it's horrible. So, anything else for the good of the order, Representative?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Dexter, for your testimony. And I think that your last point there is a real good reason that we need to have a sense of urgency. And a task force like this would, instead of looking at new programs, hopefully in a time where we have limited resources, but those are shrinking, that we would look at how we're spending those resources today and redirect some of our efforts to have people coming out of college. I mean, today we have people coming out of colleges that can't get jobs. And if we could get down there at a sooner level, like you're saying in the seventh grade wood shop, those kinds of things, we'd have people coming out that could get jobs because they would be focused. But we can't wait a year to get a committee appointed to make this happen. So, thank you.
And if I could speak to Representative Edwards' question about do we really need another task force, this is a good question. But I think the answer is yes. And the reason is the more state leadership we have for current technical education, the better. And the more reporting back that we have to the legislature in terms of what's happening and accountability that was mentioned by Representative Esquivel, this is all very helpful. And we're farther ahead today than we were two or three years ago. And I'll just give you one good example, and I know Representative Esquivel is familiar with the program called ACE out in the Park Rose area. I mean, and that's happened really without legislative support, and it's a partnership between labor, apprenticeship organizations, and education. And they're doing a great job, and that's just one good example. But we need to be doing more of things like the ACE Academy throughout the state of Oregon.
Couldn't agree more. All right, well, thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. All righty, then. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2732. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2457.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2457 allows the State Plumbing Board to authorize a journeyman plumber who obtains training and certification from a board-recognized provider to design fire sprinkler systems for one- and two-family dwellings. It provides that a journeyman plumber designing a fire sprinkler system within the scope of the board's authorization is not engaged in the practice of architecture or the practice of engineering. You have in front of you, members, a -1 amendment that replaces the bill. The amendment allows a journeyman plumber licensee to design the plumbing portion of a fire sprinkler system for installation in either a residential structure that is subject to the low-rise residential building code or any appurtenances, I always mispronounce this word, to a residential structure of any type. It's too early, Mr. Chair.
It's early enough. All right, Mr. Murray and Mr. Roach, please. Joe, when you guys want to go first, Ron, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters, and we are the author of this bill. I'll be brief. I understand there are just some policy nuances to this bill and that there isn't great disagreement with what we're trying to achieve. It's just how we're trying to get there. And I'll leave that to Mr. Long to define. Just historically, a little over a decade ago, the Oregon Fire Service came to the United Association and asked us to create a residential fire sprinkler program, and that is, in fact, what we did. Working in partnership with the Portland Fire Bureau, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, the City of Gresham Fire Department, we did create what is called the Oregon Model, which is America's model for the installation of residential fire sprinkler systems. Every system that's installed in the state of Oregon is installed to a national standard. It's called the National Fire Protection Association 13D, of which I was a member of that national committee to help write the standard for which these plumbing-based systems are installed. And NFPA 13D, which is the standard we've adopted in the state of Oregon, addresses the plumbing authority as the authority having jurisdiction over the installation of these systems. There's also an American National Standard Institute standard for the professional qualification for the designers and installers of this system. It's called ASSC 7000. And as you're aware, an ANSI standard is a standard that's put together under a collaborative effort. It's a nationally recognized standard. And it is, in this particular case, the standard was committee was comprised of fire service personnel, plumbers, and engineers. And that requires a special course for anyone that is going to install a plumbing-based system to take. I'm also a member of the National Fire Prevention Foundation, which recently concluded that Oregon was the most cost-effective state in the United States for the installation of residential fire sprinklers. And the reason for that was very simple. We install plumbing-based systems, and we've been very creative in working with the plumbing board to reduce the costs of these systems. The foundation found that the cost in the state of Oregon for a plumbing-based system was approximately 50% of that of the next state on a per square foot basis. The state of Oregon has been recognized for the work that the plumbers have done cooperatively with the fire service in the state of Oregon. There is no doubt that we install the finest fire sprinkler systems, plumbing-based fire sprinkler systems in the world, and we've created that model. And what basically the bill before you is, we believe there's somewhat of a nuance in the law that cuts off at 4,000 square feet where the plumber can design the system. And we are basically trying to make this law more consistent with the other building code laws. So.
And thank you. Before we go to Mr. Rocha, there's some nice people that are going, they're against this language, I believe. We're working with them to get some kind of amended language that we can get everybody on board with.
Yes, sir. I believe that's correct.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Roach, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I am, by way of a little history, the chair of the Portland ASSE organization, the sanitary engineers. I sit with the board of the plumbing engineers, and I've installed plumbing and fire sprinklers myself for 25 and 30 years. None of those organizations have any objection to this. The 4,000-foot cutoff doesn't really make sense. And I can go into a lot of code history and that, but the point is that these organizations, and I've worked with consulting engineering now the last 10 years, have any objection to this bill. The plumbers are capable of doing it, and there's no reason they shouldn't be.
All right.
That's it.
I love brief, concise testimonies. It was a good job. Any questions, these gentlemen? All right. Well, we will be looking forward to the language, and I got some other folks going to come up here and share their concerns and things. Thank you very much. All right. I have Sue Lazio. Sorry, Dan, I can't read your last name. Okay. Come on up. And Raymond Miller. And Mary Lopez, why don't you come on up, too? Just pull up a chair. You can grab it on another chair if you want to, or just switch out as it goes. So whoever wants to go first, go right ahead.
You go ahead and go first.
I always go first. I'm Ray Miller. I'm a structural engineer. I'm representing the American Council of Engineering Companies. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We have no problem. Please understand, we have no problem with the plumbers putting sprinklers in the buildings. What we're having a problem is it's involved in the engineering law.
Right.
And we'd like to see that removed. Let them, you know, do their job. They have no problem, but just get it out of here. And that's ORS 672. Thank you.
Yeah,
ORS 672. And just take that section out. We'll go home.
All right. Mr. Kova shared that with us already, and I knew that was going on. And very, are you done with your testimony?
Do you have any questions?
No. Go ahead, miss.
My name is Sue Laszlo, and I am the Oregon State Board of Engineering Examiners, Land Surveyors Chair at this point in time. How are you doing?
I'm fine, yeah. I worked with Ms. Laszlo's father. He was an engineer at Morse Brothers.
Right, and I am also an engineer.
I just got to tell the story. I was in the laborers union, and I was 28, 29 years old and full of some things and vinegar. And I remember we formed up these wall panels. Yeah, that's exactly right. We had to dig out this styrofoam because it was a block out, and then that went over something else. And it was just miserable getting it out of there. And my finishing foreman went up and got your father and come down. And I'm just up. And he turns to me and goes, Mike, just calm down. What did he say? He said, we're here to, I forgot what he said, but it was just, calm down, we'll find a solution, and we'll, the easiest thing in the world to do, Mike, is complain, and we're here to find solutions to our problems, and we did, but I'll never forget, the easiest thing in the world to do is complain, and it's just words of wisdom, but he was a wonderful man to work with.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Although I would never complain, I appreciate your story. I do find it somewhat ironic that the story was delivered in immediate conjunction with your praise of the one witness's testimony for its brevity.
Well, I've never been guilty of brevity, I guess.
Well, the testimony before you actually was referring initially to the initial bill. We did see that there's an amendment here. I think with respect to the board, the concern here is the design aspect. And in fact, when we heard just testimony before, we heard that there the installation component. And as Mr. Miller has stated, the installation component for our fellow journeyman plumbers are fine. We have a real concern about the idea of design. And we've actually seen in other legislation that recently happened in 2005 with respect to the electricians, that they have gotten much more latitude and actually are coming in and doing much more electrical design, which causes us great concern. And in fact, we have law enforcement cases regarding that now, because there is a confusion between what an engineer can do and should do and what an electrician feels to do. We don't want to see this go that same route. So as Mr. Miller has asked, we'd like to not see legislation go into ORS 672.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Dan Lynch, I'm a member of the board, and I'm just echoing what she said. I'm going to be very brief. That's it.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Mari Lopez, the Executive Secretary of the Board. And we have had the Department of Justice look into the design of fire protection systems, and it does fall under the practice of engineering. There's a lot more that goes into the design than the sizing of pipes. There is a fire protection analysis, fire protection management, fire science and human behavior, fire protection systems, and passive building systems. A poorly designed fire protection system can fail to work when needed, affect the structural integrity of a building already under stress by the fire, can cause delay in the response of firefighters, and increase the danger to the occupants of the building.
Interesting. Behavior. A lot of interesting human behavior on the job site sometimes. Any questions of these good people?
And then you all working with the proponents?
We have not been.
Now you're invited. So just go do good work, and I'm sure if you want, Mr., Marshall's in the building every day, and so are the gentlemen that testified in favor of the bill, and I'm fairly confident all you smart engineers and plumbers can get together and figure this out. So I really appreciate you coming down.
Thank you.
All righty then. Does anyone else want to testify to this bill today? Mr. Long, come on up.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
No complaints.
For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes, just wanted the committee to know that from a policy standpoint, we're very comfortable with the Dash 1 amendments. We understand from the Engineers Association wanting to remove that out of Chapter 672 and put it into the plumbing law. We're fine with that. We'll work with Legislative Council to accomplish that goal. Just want to reiterate, we have codes for these systems. Plumbers have a minimum of four years of training, some five, depending on the programs.
Yeah.
There's lots of continuing education for the design of these systems. We get permits for these systems. We do a plan review, and we inspect them. So from a life safety standpoint, we're absolutely fine with what this bill's trying to accomplish.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
The earlier testimony, the blurring of the lines, I would like to, after this sometime, talk about that. And
sure.
What I definitely don't want to do is it gets so blurred that now all of a sudden we got a real problem on our hands. And if there's a problem we can avoid now rather than let it get bigger later, I would definitely like to avoid that.
I believe the Dash 1s would make this very clear.
Well, in this, but yeah. it was broader than that in earlier testimony. That's what I will talk about. It.
Sure.
All right, any questions of Mr. Long? Nope. All right, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Anyone else on this bill today? All right, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2457, and I'm going to wait until the smartest person in the room is back up here before I open another.
Here you go.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2753.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2753 authorizes changes in the fees that a pawnbroker may collect for certain items and modifies the storage fee for up to no more than 3% loans and loan renewals with a minimum charge of $2, which is in current statute, and a maximum charge of $100. It also changes a fee that can be charged for firearms required to be registered in federal law and a fee for lost, stolen, or destroyed pawn ticket of memorandum. There's also other provisions, including permitting the local governments that regulate pawnbrokers to impose a maximum fee of 10 cents for each pledge loan made, except for a renewal of the pledge loan for the purpose of administering and enforcing local government regulations. I have in front of you, we're going to hand this out to you in just a moment, a proposed amendment language from the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. In your staff measure summary, there is a synopsis of the Dash 1 amendment. The language is incorrect. I've dropped the corrected language to council, and we'll get a Dash 3 amendment, but Paul Romaine will be, and representatives of the association will walk through the hand and gross amendment for you.
And that's where we're going to have up the proponents first. Mr. Romaine and Mr. Aller. I hope I'm saying that right.
Oller.
Oller?
Oller.
Okay. And who's the third person?
Mr. Dave Griffin.
Okay, Dave. Just for future reference, unless the chair calls you up, wait patiently, because I don't have you on this list here.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. Mr. Romaine should have informed you of that. He knows how we work around here. But welcome to the Capitol.
Thank you. Strike one. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. With me are two gentlemen who will introduce themselves later and are here to answer any questions, but they own pawn shops, and so they're here to fill in if you need any technical information. Let me begin by telling you that the pawn industry is probably the original lender, if you would. We're the ones, this is the bottom, the basic lending institution that has existed pretty much forever. It's the idea that you can come in with a commodity and get something for that commodity. It's the kind of place where people go when they, a lot of them go just because they like to deal with the system, but people go when there is no other place where they can get money. This is the place where you get the $25 loan, the $50 loan, the thing that you need. It's highly regulated, and you noticed last session we were not involved in all the consumer loan controversy because, frankly, we were the model for the consumer loan, where you ended up going to. We're the folks who are highly regulated. We work with the department very, very closely. Because we are so highly regulated, and most of our stuff is in statute, we have to come to you periodically for adjustments of those statutes. Businesses change, things get a little bit confusing. So that's what we're doing. We're on our about 10 or 12-year cycle right now. I think it was 97 when we had some other changes to the industry. Now, what you see in 2753, the way we went about doing it is we sat down with the Department of Consumer and Business Services to work out all details. We proposed things, they proposed things, they had some, and they'll testify in a little bit, but we had a kind of go through what needs to be changed in this law. And the hand and gross version of the 2753 is pretty much what we collectively decided, and there's total agreement with the department. We understand, and I'll get to this a little bit later, that there is some objection from the City of Portland and the City of Eugene on one particular part of the hand and gross version on page 3, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But this is the first we've heard of that objection. Otherwise, we would have worked to bring that to you. Because the amendments did not come out of legislative council anyway, the way we needed them to come out, we had a little bit of confusion over the word this. It's amazing how one word can end up hanging things up periodically. That turns out to be a blessing in disguise because we can now work out the final detail and come back to you hopefully next week with the consensus version on this. But let me go through the bill and tell you what we're looking at. First of all, Section 1 basically is, there's nothing substantive in Section 1 of the bill. Section 2 is where you start getting into more substantive things. Section 2 is for a fee for a lost, destroyed, or stolen ticket. What happens with a pawnbroker is somebody will come in and say, my ticket was lost. Usually what happens is the kid grabbed the ticket, and or the husband grabbed the wife's ticket, or something happened, but the ticket's lost. That's a very expensive proposition for a pawnbroker because you basically are on the hook. You do all the stuff, you put it out there, you've got a risk that you're giving it to the wrong person. Simply by having a minor fee, you'll almost eliminate lost tickets. It's amazing what the having to pay $3 or $5, what we had originally proposed, that the division came back and said, no, only make it $3. We believe that will cut down on the number of people that come in with lost tickets. They will find those tickets. The Section 3 of the bill, the only substantive change in Section 3, and again, the Legislative Council went through when they drafted this thing and made some grammatical changes, which they do periodically, is in the storage fee, which is paragraph 3 of Section 3, which increases the storage fee to 3%. However, it puts a maximum charge on it the same way that we have for a setup fee. So before, there was no maximum charge. Now you're sticking a maximum charge, so you can't go more than a $100 charge. Section 4 of the bill is where we kept running into this controversy, but what we do is we charge a fee of $3 for firearms. It's charged one time only. It cannot be charged upon a renewal, although other fees can be charged upon a renewal. So we reflect that to make sure in that. There's the language that says the pawnbroker may not charge this fee. It did say a fee, which was a little too broad, to renew the pledge. We can also pass through any government fee for holding or transferring the firearm. Section 5 basically clarifies, Section 5 is the one that basically clarifies when the notices need to be sent out. Currently today, we have to send, there's no notice sent out if the pledge, if it's under $500 under statute. If there's a, if it's between $500, if it's above $500, we send out a certified letter. Well, in reality, what happens is nobody picks up their certified mail. People just really do not pick up certified mail. And working with the division, we basically decided that it's actually more effective is to have a requirement that we send it by regular mail, because people tend to actually pick up regular mail. So if people who are forfeiting something generally have other problems where they're not going to really be doing it. Once you get up to $2,500, though, you probably should have that requirement that they get both the regular mail and the certified mail. Certified mail is an expensive proposition. So with working with the department, we say that basically send it regular mail up to $2,500, between $500 and $2,500, and above that, certified mail. The area that we're running into a little bit of not controversy, but a little confusion over, is the new Section 7 of the bill. And what that does is allow us to pass through local government fees. Now, what local governments, a few local governments today, I think it's Eugene and Springfield, the only ones right now, have instituted sort of computer programs, and they charge the pawnbroker a fee to track goods. That fee, when it's done as a lump sum, is impossible for us to pass on. When it's done as a lump sum, as it's done down in Eugene, I think in Springfield, I don't know if it's in Eugene or not, but in one of the jurisdictions, when pawnbrokers tried to pass it on, the division said, no, you can't pass it on because there's no way to figure out, you know, all your fees are in statute. There's no authorization to pass this on. So you have to, the only way we will allow you to do it is we change it to a transaction fee. We came up with a transaction fee concept, put that in. The division basically said we need a cap on that fee because you can't be sitting there passing on $3 and $4 fees to a consumer who's coming in with a $25 loan. So the division came up with a 10-cent cap on it. We would be, that cap seems to make local governments nervous whenever you're capping what they can charge. So as a compromise, what we've been talking about is giving the division the authority by rule to cap that fee. You want the local government to be able to charge, but you don't want it to make it so onerous that the consumer really becomes a consumer negative. So that's the part we're going to work out the language, hopefully with the local governments, and come back to you next week with that particular language. I think I covered in all the areas. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, as you spoke to earlier, there's some nice people that are going to share some concerns about this.
Right.
And just like the last bill, you're going to reach out and work something out with these
definitely
nice people.
And the department, Mr. Chair, will be coming up and testifying on the bill. And, again, this is a joint effort with them.
And then maybe you guys can answer this question, but I've never even been in a pawn shop. So if I take my gun in there and we come to some amount and I leave it there with my ticket, is there a contract or an agreement that I will be back by a certain amount of time and giving you money back, I imagine. I don't know if there's interest. There is interest in that. But if I'm not back by that time, then you can sell with it, right? Is that how it works?
Right.
Okay. I hope to God I never have to pawn anything, but...
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name's Earl Oler. Mm-hmm. I'm president of the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. Pawnbrokers in this state have always been regulated to the hilt for good reasons. We like to be regulated, we like to be above board, and we like to do the things the right way. All our loan contractors are bearer bonds. That means that anybody has that ticket, that's just like if you got a $50 loan, that's like walking around with a $50 bill. You can come in and you don't need identification to come in and claim that ticket. So that speaks to some of the points that Paul made on the lost ticket issue. It poses a big risk on our part. All the regulations that we have worked for, and I've been doing this business for almost 40 years. I've appeared before your committees for almost that long to try to strengthen our laws. Our laws are strengthened to protect us and to protect our consumer base. So we don't take very lightly on responsibility. We all assume the responsibility of giving an item out to somebody that does not belong to that item.
Yes, Mr. Chair, your scenario, basically, you would come in with an item, they'd value the item, they would hold the item, there's certain statutory hold requirements. You can renew the loan, you could pay it off. It's basically a bank. We're the entry-level bank.
Right.
We're regulated just like the banks are regulated.
Thank you. Sir, did you have some testimony?
I don't think so.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that the point of controversy vis-a-vis cities is Section 7. My questions are actually involving the notice requirements in Section 5.
Okay.
And I get a little nervous when we're starting to tinker with the notice requirements. Now, I understand the argument that actually in a certain class of cases, regular mail is actually more effective notice than certified mail. I also understand certified mail, I think it costs around $3, certified mail return receipt requested. I understand how that's a meaningful burden in large numbers on the business. However, for example, a registered mail, I believe, accomplishes about 95% of what certified mail does. And I believe it's about half the price. So if we were to, for example, as many contracts require, require both registered mail, return receipt requested, as well as U.S. mail, we would actually be providing better notice at less cost than is the status quo. I'm wondering how you guys would feel about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, actually that's an interesting idea. We'd be happy to go back and look at it. This came up actually when we went in to request an additional amount, a fee, in effect, authorization to charge more for the certified letter. The certified letter not only means that you, the cost of the postage, it's the cost of taking it down to the post office, doing all that stuff. If we can divide, and in negotiations with DCBS, it was, well, gosh, what's the most effective way? And then we came to this, people really don't pick it up. So we'd be happy to go back and talk to DCBS about something like that. That's an interesting idea. We'd have to discuss it, and maybe that would work.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. The reason the law currently has essentially a bright line. Everything under $500 essentially is no notice.
Right.
Everything over has fairly relatively expensive and arguably less effective notice. I admit that's imperfect, but it's also very clear in terms of statute and parsimony.
Right.
What you're proposing under Section 5? Is essentially a three-tiered system, and suddenly it begs the question, why don't we actually require regular first-class notice for all transactions, for example, even those under 500? I mean, the arguments apply there. I think you're getting into some some muddy water a bit that actually might make your lives harder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, we're not trying to make our lives harder. We're actually trying to make the consumer's, both the consumer's life and our life easier.
That's what we're here for, too, Mr.
Right.
Romain.
I realize
every
that.
Single
and,
day.
I guess I'm used to three-tiered systems, so it's a... But we were trying to be practical, and what I would tell you is that we would love to look at any way that we can get notice to the consumer that their loan is going to be forfeited unless they act. That doesn't burden the consumer with additional costs, substantial additional costs, and is effective. And that's why, you know, when you mentioned the registered letter scenario, that may be a way to handle things. I don't know why it's probably a cost issue more than anything else, under $500. I don't know why, but there's never been notice for those under $500. But once you get into what seems to be a substantial loan, then, or a substantial piece of jewelry or whatever you're pawning, then the notice came in there. Again, we'll work with the department. We'll come up with the best possible thing. The department protects the consumer in this situation, and we'll work with them to make sure that they're in line with it.
Please, once as you're chatting with the DCBS, please circle back with me.
We would be happy to circle back with you.
And before I go to Mr.
Always a pleasure.
Before I go to Representative Witt, I wonder if the word certified is throughout the statute in whenever there's a notification, rather than registered, or if it's registered here or certified there. Why certified rather than registered is my question, and I wonder if it's throughout the statute that it's one or not the other or both.
Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to, again, we'll yeah. work with this. If it's a way for us to cut down on administrative hassle, if it's a way to get notice out more effectively, it's a great idea. We'll be happy to go with it.
Great, thank you. Representative Witt, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if there's a... a typical loan to value rate is that set in statute? Is it determined otherwise? How are values determined?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, there's nothing set in statute. It's simply somebody comes in, you know, for example, you come in with a gold chain. The value of a gold chain today may be totally different than the value of a gold chain a month from now or something. So somebody is making a determination that they, with not a lot of risk, can loan you up to X amount of dollars on that gold chain. And, you know, if you don't come back, then they've got that to sell, you know, after a period of time of holding it. And but there's nothing, I don't think there's anything that's set on value. I don't know if any of you guys, how do you make that determination? Is it arbitrary? Or?
It's arbitrary. It depends on the merchandise. Depends on the gold market, if it's gold. It depends on the diamond market, if it's diamond. It depends on the customer history. Age of computer is a great thing, just like the banks do. You can tell whether you have a good customer. You can have a bad customer. If you have a good customer, you're going to tend to lend more on that customer. Try to help them out.
Excuse me, did anybody have their phone on? That's what's causing this buzzing sound.
BlackBerry.
Or BlackBerry. You got any gadget, shut it off. Please.
I might also, one of the most common misconceptions that anybody that's not familiar with the pawn industry has is that if I ask you the question of how many items do you think a pawnbroker forfeits, what is the percentage? Can anybody just give me a guess off the top of your head?
20%. I'll just throw a number out there.
Okay. Anybody think it's higher? How? Take a guess. I heard
all right.
60%.
Bear us the suffering and get to the end.
Earl, answer.
most pawnbrokers in the state of Oregon, forfeiture rate is somewhere between 9% and 11%.
Wow.
That means that most of our customers come back for their loans. Okay. That also sheds light in when we're talking about the certified and the letters. Years ago,
When I started, loans were for a year. Anything over $30 at that particular time, this is 35, 40 years ago, required a certified letter. Every 12 years, we go back and we adjust it because we adjust it for inflation. $500, which was good maybe 15, 20 years ago, now with the price of gold up to $1,000, because gold back then was $200 to $300, it doesn't take much for a pawnbroker to make a $500 loan. It's the same thing as making a $100 loan 15 years ago. What that has done is shifted our labor into sending out all these certified letters. And all we were asking is to get some relief between the $500 and the $2,500 so that we don't have to go through. We can make another cost adjustment on sending out certified letters. That's our basis on it. The value of the stuff that we've loaned has gone up like everything else.
Thank you. Any further questions, please, gentlemen, before we move on? All right. Well,
thank you.
Go forth and do good.
We'll bring you back a good product.
All right. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. I'm going to call, Troy King, Dan Barnaby.
Is David Barnaby?
Oh, Barenberg. God, David. Harry Dreher. Is David in there? Okay, there he is. And Randall Berwer?
Berger,
forgive me. Come on up, guys. And then I have two folks after that. Unless there's anybody else, we'll be done for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I'm going to borrow Representative Esquivel's line from earlier in the week. I am David Barenberg, and I am from the helpful city of Portland. And I think we'll try to make...
That's a lot better than the city that works.
And I'm sure, Mr. Chair, a lot cheaper to come up with. We'll try to be brief. Essentially, the issues that we bring from the city perspective is just that the cap on the amount that can be charged for transactions is very low. Currently, there are very few cities do charge any fee on transactions. Though in the case of the city of Portland, where we don't charge a fee currently, and to the best of my knowledge, we have no intentions at the moment of charging a fee, but we do have very great expenses that we do incur in terms of enforcement around industry issues. That the city of Portland spends approximately $80,000 on just the record-keeping technical end of entering data into the system, comparing and looking at items that are pawned versus items that are stolen and entered into a database. We also have a police unit of which Sergeant King heads that works around with the 13 pawn shops and 120 secondhand stores that there are in the city on these related issues. So while we understand the concern that's the essence of Section 7, which is that the pawnbrokers aren't able, with the regulation they currently receive from DCBS, to pass on the cost of any local government fee. That is something that we can understand and support their ability to do. The issue that we have is with the limit that they have imposed. And with that, I can say that we are engaging in discussions with the ABLE representatives from the Pawnbroker Association and DCBS, spoken with the Oregon Law Center, and hope to bring you back a solution to this issue. And with that, are my colleagues from law enforcement, if you have any, the committee has any questions on what they do and how they track records and how they do enforcement, we're happy to answer them. Or if you'd rather move on, we're happy to move on.
If you gentlemen have some testimony, please feel free. We have plenty of time. I do have a question, though. Southeast 82nd and Woodstock, there was a, that was it last year, it was a big raid there. Was that a pawnbroker there, or what?
In 2006, there was,
2006.
It was a secondhand store.
Secondhand store.
Yes. Sergeant King served.
Yeah. I think I read, quoted in the paper during that.
No, that was before I came to the detail.
Oh, forgive me then.
But what's the difference between a secondhand store and a pawnbroker? I guess that's something I... Or is there a difference?
Yes, sir.
Well, clearly you just go in and sell it, and then they resell it. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Shuffler. The difference between a buy and sell store or secondhand store is they buy a property and they in turn sell it. A pawn shop has the ability to do that as well. But in addition to that, a pawn shop has the ability to give out loans.
They're a lending institution. And it, if I may, is there a bigger problem in either one, or are the problems spread out equally? I'd imagine most business people comply with the law and are legitimate, but do you see more of this trade or selling of stolen goods in secondhand stores or pawn shops, or is it spread out among equally? Do you have any...
My experience is it's spread out fairly evenly. Many of the pawn shops are larger shops, at least in the community of Eugene and Springfield, and they get a little more business, and therefore I spend a little more time in that those stores. But I think percentage-wise, they're probably fairly even as far as locating and recovering stolen property.
Was that your question specifically regarding whether the stolen property occurs more at one than the other?
Yeah, it was spread out evenly for those few businesses that choose to be out of compliance with the law. So, okay. Representative Holby, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, Mr. Barenberg, if you stated some fees and expenses that the city of Portland incurs in, you know, monitoring the goods that go through pawn shops and trying to keep track of that, you know, looking for stolen property, I'm sure, and other activity that sometimes the pawn shops aren't really privy to. Do you operate, I guess I got a two-part question, do you do the same thing with these buy and sell stores as well and look at the goods that are going in and out of them? And then how does the city generally pay for that type of work? Is that something that's just absorbed by the general fund of the city?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Holby, I'll answer part of your question and then punt to the sergeant, if I may. The police budget is primarily funded from our general fund property taxes, so it is paid as any other expense. As the state is suffering financial challenges, the city is also facing financial challenges in reducing services and and so there is increased demand on resources within our budget. One number that I failed to mention I thought was very interesting that the city of Portland monitors in its database 120,000 transactions, 100,000 of which are on the pawn side and 20,000 of which are on the secondhand side. And there's a list of items for the secondhand stores in terms of what it is that gets reported, so it's not shirts and other things. And to the more specific part of your question, I'd like to pass the microphone to the sergeant.
Chair Schaffler and Representative Holby. To answer your question with regard to how we deal with those shops, essentially our responsibility for monitoring the activity, doing inspections, background checks on all of their employees and those sorts of things are the same for both. We treat both in terms of when they do a renewal, the criteria for renewing their license and that sort of thing is essentially the same. So the costs associated for law enforcement with dealing with one shop that's a secondhand store and another that might be a pawn shop are essentially the same. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Just follow up. So in your enforcement of that, do you enforce this particular statute, or are you geared towards other parts of investigation and laws that you're looking for and theft and those sorts of things?
Well, we don't enforce this particular statute. We do have, as many city and county governments have, an ordinance that regulates pawn shops and secondhand stores. And so that is our enforcement tool. It gives us the authority to inspect the premises at any time during normal business hours. It requires us to go through certain procedures to approve new employees and that sort of thing. So we have quite a large amount of responsibility in terms of doing what Mr. Oler referred to as being like to be regulated. We also like to regulate them because if we work together, then it helps keep the industry clean. They benefit, we benefit. So it's really the local ordinance that gives us the guidelines for the types of regulation that we do with the industries.
Thank you. It's just a terrible irony that right when your resources to do your jobs are going down, the demand for this service is going up, and right when you really probably need to be regulating it the most. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted, in this discussion about the potential for a passing hot merchandise, to make sure that the reputation of the loan industry, the pawn industry, is not tarnished. These are folks that are in business to loan money. And quite frankly, as business people, have a great deal to lose in terms of the merchandise that they've loaned on should they be selling hot property and it were confiscated. So background checks on the individual, identification, registration numbers, if there are any, on the merchandise that's pawned. I think, Mr. Chairman, it's a very reputable industry that tries as far as they can to be above board in every instance.
And, Representative, I'm grateful you further and more elaborately and articulately clarified what I just said to you. The vast majority of business people are legitimate, law-abiding folks. Unfortunately, in every business, there's always some miserable bustard out there that thinks they can get away with something, and then you go knocking on their door, and I appreciate you doing it. So, any further questions of these gentlemen? And obviously, there's some work to be done, and we'll have you all come back and work together with these nice folks, and I'm pretty sure we can get some squared away here. All righty then. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
I have Sybil Hebb and Adam Walsh, please. If there's anybody else today, after these good people, you're welcome to come on up. Go ahead, sir. Since you sat down, go for it.
Thank you, Chair Schauffler, members of the committee. Adam Walsh of the City of Eugene had the pleasure of hearing briefly from Detective Berger. At this time, I don't have anything else to add. I'll just leave it over to Ms. Hebb.
Thank you. Chair Schauffler, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. Thanks for the time today. We represent low-income consumers across the state of Oregon, and I wanted to first just express appreciation to the industry for seeking feedback about this proposal as they were moving through the process. And we do believe that the Dash 2 amendments are good amendments, and so we support those. I did want to just actually speak to the issue that Representative Barton raised about the certified mail process. And I've been gathering information and looking at this issue in other contexts, and I do believe that, the bill as proposed sets out sort of a different set of criteria for notice for loans below $2,500. Those are actually still fairly significant loans, especially to consumers who are in our income index. And those loans are also secured by belongings that are worth far more than that amount. And so we would be interested in having greater notice proposals or requirements for those sorts of loans. And I believe that the representative's suggestion of regular mail as well as registered mail would be a great way to solve that problem. So we would be supportive of looking at that language. So thank you very much.
And Sybil, do you know, and maybe Mr. Tapman or some legal scholar knows, I asked, is certified the word we use throughout the statute, or is it a mixture? Right. When it comes to notification process.
Chair Schauffler, members of the committee, the certified mail and registered mail are two different things.
Right.
The Administrative Procedures Act, which applies to many circumstances and contexts in which I'm used to thinking about notice, requires certified mail. I don't know of another statute that requires registered mail, but I think that it's a viable solution, and there may be others out there. I just don't know about them. So,
yes.
Mr. Chair, I can follow up with Legislative Council and get that information.
Well, and then my question then next would be, I'd rather not. I like consistency. It really makes my life and everyone's life and the citizens' lives a lot easier. I don't want to get into a situation where, well, it's registered over here, certified over there, regular over there. This is my personal desire. One word used. If we can't, then maybe we do just do a patchwork.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, just to clarify, though, this is a process to which the Administrative Procedures Act does not apply. So there would be consistency throughout cases, circumstances in which the Administrative Procedures Act applies, but this would, is outside of that context. So I think registered mail would be allowed and I think it might be a viable way of achieving good notice.
And I don't think this committee will be rewriting the Administrative Procedures Act anytime soon. But yes, Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, first of all, actually, believe it or not, I'm not kidding. Actually, I think next week there are several bills that actually will rewrite the Administrative Procedures Act for certain proceedings. Next week, I'm
in judiciary?
No, in this committee. I'm not kidding, actually.
Okay. I look forward to that.
That's point one. Point two, just to clarify, you mean registered versus certified throughout this particular chapter, not throughout the Oregon Revised Statute, correct?
I don't know. That's why I asked. I'm learning, too.
Chair Schaffler, I think I'll defer to others about this particular statute, whether there are other places where registered mail would be allowed. I think that it would be, it would be easy to let people know what the requirements were, and registered mail would be a viable option in combination with regular mail. I think that's the best way to assure notice to people.
I'm just grateful I have members who know what we're going to be doing next week.
What I'm here for, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Tatman, would you want to speak to this, or?
Mr. Chair, I'd love to speak to this.
Great. Please.
Mr. Chair. As long as we're waiting for what certain administrative proceedings, disciplinary proceedings, for example, are subject to the APA, and there's some proposals to change, for example, where the ALJ, the administrative law judge, what he reviews, it's very much at the heart of the APA.
Yeah, right. Good. I look forward to that.
I have no idea what my good colleague is talking about, but I learned something every day.
Amen, bro.
Today, I learned how to properly use the word parsimony.
Did I say that? Representative?
Go ahead, sir.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is David Tatman. For the record, I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And as you've heard, first of all, the admonition from the chair to keep this brief, I understand I'm keeping you from getting done, so I will try and move this along. I've asked to have my testimony handed out to you, so rather than reiterate it, a number of interesting points have come up. I think you've heard from Mr. Romaine and members of the various cities. There's a couple of issues left to be discussed. I will speak to the issue. We regulate 13 different programs. Of all those programs, I've yet to see us use anything but certified and regular mail. I'm intrigued by the idea that maybe there are other ways to do this because, unfortunately, we are finding that people do not like picking up certified mail, particularly those who are facing financial challenges. So the goal is to get notice to people, and the best way to get notice is the way that they will pick it up. So whatever that is, that's what we want to do. You heard from Mr. Romaine about this. We've spent considerable amount of time talking with him and members of his organization. There are a number of fees involved in the PON process. We recognize there are times where there's a need to have the fees reflect our current economic environment, if you will, without indexing them, but adjusting them periodically because they are in statute. We think of the proposals that are in the bill, as have been outlined for you, they make sense. Most of them still are within a fairly narrow band. We're bumping up a couple from 2% to 3%, but in addition to that, though, we're putting a cap on those. We think it's appropriate that most of the time these fees don't need to go up above a certain amount. And as usual, it's case history that makes most legislative changes. We had a case a year ago in which somebody took in a pledge of a lot of silver bullion. It was valued above $2,500. There were a lot of problems with that, and that's what's kind of driving this. That's why we're trying to put a cap on that. That's why we're trying to make sure the notice is done properly, and that's why we want to make clear that they can renew these loans. There's a lot of ambiguity about whether you can renew or not renew a loan, so that's the changes. The crux of what's still left to be done is Section 7, as you've heard. Our goal was to say, look, there's a fee that the pawnbrokers are charged by law enforcement so that they check the serial numbers or they check the item that has been pledged to make sure it's not a hot item, a stolen item. All we wanted to do was say, yes, you can pass that on. The 10 cents was really just to pass that on. And I didn't understand the concerns of the city until I looked at the law, or the proposed law. And the proposed law says we would limit how much the cities can collect for the regulation. Well, it wasn't our intention to come in here and tell the cities how to regulate pawnbrokers in terms of law enforcement. We regulated them from a point of consumer protection and compliance. Law enforcement does their own thing. We don't want to get in the middle of that. So our goal was just to limit what the fee was to do this one computer check. As it's written right now, though, it looks like we're trying to cap all activities and put it under 10 cents. So we need to come back with our friends with the cities and with the Pawnbrokers Association and get this hammered out. So my goal is to pledge to you, no pun intended, but pledge to you that we'll get this done and come back to you.
Yeah, and that neat, nice, neat, clean bill, that's what I want. All right.
We're with you.
Go forth and do any questions. Representative Holby.
No real questions, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to state on behalf of the Committee on Consumer Protection, we were very happy to sponsor this bill and ship it to you, this really simple bill that has consumer issues, business practice issues, and regulatory issues all rolled in one, and very interesting bill.
Well, we are here to ease your burden, Mr. Chair. All righty then. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Anybody else want to testify on this bill today?
Yes. Before we close the public hearing, I want to enter in the record some written testimony from Michael Novak from the League of Oregon Cities, and I believe it expresses their concerns with Section 7 of the bill as well.
Okay. So. All right. Very good. Anyone else? All right. I'm going to close the hearing. House Bill 2753. Anything for the good of the order, people?
It was an interesting meeting today.
Yeah, we
pawnbrokers and home health care workers and through technical education and fire sprinkler systems.
We really covered a lot of ground here today. All right. If nothing else, we're adjourned. Have a good weekend.